o'clock. So we'll go ahead and call the June Public Health Advisory Committee or Council to order. And I'll first do a roll call. Tonight we're not going to do a warm-up activity. We're just going to ask you to say present or I'm here or good evening or whatever, because we have a very full agenda tonight and we didn't want to take the extra time to do the little warm-up activities. So anyway, we'll start with the roll call. And do we have Ashley? See her here tonight. Brian Scarlett Fisher. Chad Williams. Pretty sure I
Hello.
saw you.
Yep, I'm here.
I'm
Alma Bloom.
here. I couldn't get my unmute button to work. I'm here.
Okay. I'm glad you're here. I can't see everybody, so Elma. She's here. Emily Estes. I see her
Here.
face. Franklin Johnson. I don't see Frank. Jeannie Mills Goodling.
Here.
Dr. Fisher. I don't see. Dr. Duppin. Dr. Tong.
Here.
Great. Lori Schott.
Here.
Lori Lynn Lord.
Here.
Mark Collier. Marla Sanger.
I'm here.
Oh, great. Hi, Marla.
Hi.
Michael Watkins.
Here.
Paul Childers.
Here.
Robert Ferrier. I'm here. Scott Johnson.
Here.
Tracy Fernandez.
Here.
Tyler Clary.
Here.
Council Fuentes.
Here.
Dr. Melnick.
I'm here.
Andrea Pruitt. Dana Nijin. Danette York.
Here.
Jeff Harbison.
Yep, I'm home.
Dr. DeSilvia Bhatia. Amy Wilson.
Here.
And Amy Koski.
Here.
Did I miss anybody? Right. Do we have any guests, Mallory?
We have a very special guest.
We have a special guest.
Very, very special guest.
Outside of our very special honored guest.
I don't see anyone from the public,
Okay.
but we do have Jamie Bowden with Wasalfo with us. And then I also see that we have Melissa Martins with Clark County Public Health as well.
Okay. Hi, Melissa.
Hi, Sandy, and I think Caroline's on as well from our climate team. I thought I saw
Okay.
her.
Okay, I see her now. Yeah.
Hello.
All right. Our next piece of business is to review and approve our minutes from last month. And again, Mallory sent those out, and hopefully everybody had a chance to read and review those. Does anybody have any comments or additions or changes to the minutes? I'm hearing none. All of those in favor, say aye or raise your hand.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Anybody, anyone opposed? Okay, the minutes for the May meeting have been approved. Our next topic is with Jamie Bowden, and I'm going to have Dr. Melnick introduce Jamie and our topic for the evening.
We're really fortunate to have Jamie here. Jamie is the director of our state association of the Washington State Association of Local Public Health Officials. So all the local health jurisdictions in the state are members of WSLFO, and she's an expert on all things related to local public health jurisdictions in the state of Washington, including the associated statutes, administrative code, all things public health. She was willing. So you know, the issue that we discussed at the retreat with the Board of Health was related to the statute that passed a few years ago that created this. We have two models for boards of health in the state: the one with the boards of health that with non-elected officials, and then with boards of health that are only elected folks, but also have a community health advisory board, which is what FAC is. And if you might recall that in creating that statute, the legislature actually used the FAC bylaw. So folks have asked for an independent, I think, Jamie exudes integrity. She's going to give you an independent analysis from her standpoint of the two models of how local health, you know, the policymakers for local health jurisdictions are structured. So I'll leave it at that. I've said enough already. So I'll leave it to Jamie.
Well, thank you, Alan. I don't know if I am deserving of the generous praise. I feel like I always know enough to be dangerous. I don't know if I would consider myself an expert in anything, and I can always be bribed with ice cream and puppies. So if you need an expert opinion, always will say yes to puppies and ice cream. But thank you for the invite. I know some of you have come to local Board of Health trainings in the past, so some familiar faces, and so hopefully not a completely unfamiliar topic, but happy to come present, give some thoughts, share some perspective, and hopefully continue some good conversation that you all are having around this issue. Would it be easiest if I share my screen and drive the presentation? I'm seeing fingers.
I can go ahead and do it. Okay. I will share it in just a second. Sorry.
Oh, no worries. All righty. So jumping right into it, go ahead and go to the next slide. If you're not familiar, public health is acronym city. And so I like to throw up some of the common acronyms that I just say I don't even really think about anymore on here. There are probably going to be some that I miss, and I'll say if there are any, please feel free to raise your hands and just be like, what was that? Or what do you mean? It's also a wonderful field when you have acronyms that mean like three or four different things. So it could be where I'm saying something and the context isn't lining up. So please, if you don't understand something, please raise your hand so I can explain myself. Next slide. We're going to jump right in. So public health in Washington State, you are on an advisory board probably for a reason. So something probably that you've talked about in retreats and other things, but I like to just kind of pose these questions to the group as you have this conversation, as I'm presenting to you. You know, public health is a lot of things. And so everybody kind of has their purpose and reason of why public health is important to you or why it means something to you, why you're serving on an advisory board. So some things to just think about: what are those issues that are most important to you? What motivates you when you're making decisions? For me, I love public health because I strongly believe in public service and dedicating time and putting energy and work into improving the communities in which I live. Service is something that's important to my family. I grew up with it and carry it with me. Public health issues are important to me. I'm a policy wonk. I love policy things. I believe, you know, that's where we do good work and have a lot of impact. And for me, for motivating decisions, local public health is near and dear to my heart. And so I am all about empowering our local health departments in Washington State to do what's best for their own communities. So that's what motivates me every day. And seeing Alan smile always motivates me. Next slide, Mallory. So Washington's governmental public health system, I'm sure this is a little bit of a review for all of you, but we're a home rule state. So everything is decentralized, which means local control is really important in Washington state. That's true for public health. It's true for other local governments. Counties and cities have a lot of responsibility delegated to them that they are in charge of or mandated to do and obligated to do on behalf of the state. Local health jurisdictions, so could be health departments, could be health districts. They are all governed by a local board of health. That is a requirement in state statutes. Some are county departments, some are districts, some are single county districts, some are multi-county districts. And statutory authority is given to both the local board of health and local health officers. So there's kind of some dual authority roles in that, but overall, the oversight is given to the local boards of health. At our state level, we have the State Board of Health. They do a lot of the rulemaking and policy. They do a lot of health impact reviews with the state legislature. And then our State Department of Health, which is led by a Secretary of Health, soon to be Secretary Worsham, who comes from Snohomish County. And the Department of Health funds and administers and directs a lot of statewide public health programs. And then we also have tribal nations health centers, urban Indian health institutes. So between local, state, and tribal, that makes up kind of our governmental public health system. So if you'll hear us talk about that, we're talking about four sectors, two at the state level, local, and then tribal. Next slide. So what do we look like across the state? There are kind of five different compositions or categories in which health departments exist. The most common one is actually County Health and Human Services, also called County Health and Community Services, County Health and Public Health Services, County Health and Community Health Services. You could call it a lot of different things. It's essentially a County Health and Human Services function. So oversight by the county legislative authority, often County Board of County Commissioners, sometimes council, sometimes commission, depending on home rule or not home or charter or non-charter counties. Clark County is a charter county, so you are a little bit unique in that you have a council instead of a board. You also have county health departments. Then you also have single county health districts, such as Garfield or Grant or Yakima. And then you also have multi-county districts, such as Chelan Douglas or Northeast Tri-County. The purpose of that is typically a lot of the population tends to be consolidated right across county borders. And so it's a very mobile population between the two counties. So it makes a lot of sense to become a multi-county health district. So five different types. And there's also the city county health departments, such as Tacoma Pierce and Seattle King. So many different ways you can be a local health jurisdiction in our state, which offers some unique opportunities. Next slide. But regardless of that, all LHJs have the same statutory obligations to fulfill. Every LHJ, whether you're a district or a health department, you have the same mandates. Counties are obligated to fund local health jurisdictions. In fact, they are the only ones who are obligated to fund local health jurisdictions. The state is, with Foundational Public Health Services funding, that obligation is also now shared by the state. But before FPHS, it was just counties that were mandated. States could and could pass through federal funding as well. So that's something I like to like keep in mind is that counties are those payers of last resort. Cities are not obligated to fund local health jurisdictions. Uniquely, health districts are able to pull city fundings in a way that county health departments are not. Just a fun fact of in the uniqueness of that composition. All local health jurisdictions are required to have the same, they have the same requirements for local health officers as well as local boards of health. So all local health jurisdictions are required to have a local and appoint a local health officer, and they're all required to be governed by a local board of health. There are some exemption criteria, and I'll go over that in a little bit. A local health jurisdiction might require, if you're a district, local board of health and or county resolution for certain programs. So thinking of our environmental health is probably the most common. Your septic programs, your food programs, those have both local health jurisdiction components to it, but then they're also likely connected to other county functions, particularly septic and water, with your planning departments at the city and county level. The same kind of scope of program services and partnerships exist. Some of those core functions are on FPHS. And then districts might take on some of the human services roles that your county health and human service agencies might, but they're contracted with that in a different way. So they're contracted via the state, not necessarily from the county, but they might be providing similar services. So they might look more like a county health and human services agency, even though they're a health district. Next slide. So working with your local government, there are a couple differences. I've starred the more turquoise looking one because that is what Clark County is. You are a department or function of county government versus kind of a special purpose district. So you follow county operating principles and policies. Your local health jurisdiction budget is part of the larger county budget. You have access to other county operations such as finance, HR, legal, through your prosecuting attorneys. And again, you might have some of that human services scope of work underneath that county function. As districts, they're independent to, but connected to county government. So they operate under bylaws and articles of incorporation. They have an independent budget outside of county government. And so they're able to draw both county and city funds. They're required to provide their own operational or administrative functions. So legal, they often contract that out. HR, they do that all in-house. Finances, they do that all in-house. And then they often have MOU agreements with county government to maybe do some of that. So have access to, say, the prosecuting attorney or have access to some of the IT infrastructure like email or something like that. Next slide. Drivers of LHJ work, laws, rules, that the state legislature and state agencies pass. That's the bread and butter, the RCWs and the WACs. There might also be things around federal block grants and state grants that are categorical and specific. So for example, the maternal child health or MCH block grant that happens at the federal level, that can be spent on maternal and child health activities, not non-maternal and child health activities. So there might be some obligations there to fund specific work with specific grants. There's also the concept of chief health strategist and public health 3.0 framework that drive LHJ work, and then your local needs and priorities that you've identified through CHAWS and CHIPS. Next slide. So recent local Board of Health changes. So before 2021, the county legislative authority served as the default local Board of Health. So in most counties, that is three county commissioners, and they also served as the local Board of Health. Nothing prohibited a county from expanding and passing an ordinance to expand their local Board of Health membership. In fact, we had several local health jurisdictions that had done that, whether they were districts, and part of the appeal to be able to draw city funding is, hey, city, if you fund or put some funding towards your local health jurisdiction, will give you a Board of Health seat. So we had some jurisdictions that had expanded membership with elected officials at both the county and city level. And then we had a couple of jurisdictions that also had additional community members. So pre-2021, the default was county legislative authority, but we already had some expanded local boards of health. Then in 2021, House Bill 1152 passed, and that required all local health jurisdictions to expand their local boards of health unless very specific criteria were met. Expanded membership includes having a public health and medical expertise, community member and partners on there, membership from someone with lived experience or who receives public health services. And then if there are some tribal governments within the jurisdiction, having tribal membership as well. This past session, there was an additional bill that passed that clarified changes made to the tribal appointment process. It was very ambiguous. It was very clunky. And that caused a lot of disruption into that appointment process. So the bill clarified it and streamlined it, made it much more explicit, and then also clarified some of the tribal organizational membership for two specific jurisdictions that were required to also have tribal organizational membership. That was Public Health Seattle King County and Spokane Regional Health District. Next slide. So implementing 1152, what did that look like? We had 11 local boards of health who met that exemption criteria, who were allowed to not have to expand their local boards of health. One elected to move forward with expansion regardless. That was Public Health Seattle King County. And then another one was required to expand after moving from being a single county district to a county department, and that was Snohomish, which made that change in 2023. 24 of our 35 local health jurisdictions were required to expand by 2022. 14 of those 24 had already done so in some form beyond just the county legislative authority or the Board of County Commissioners. 10 had community members as part of that expanded. 4 had just city officials. So there was already some expansion. That didn't mean that they were already compliant or in line with the statute. They might have needed to make some additional changes. But as of this year, all local boards of health have either expanded or have maintained their exemption, with 6 local boards of health having their county legislative authority as their local board of health. Clark County is one of those. And I have another star with that 11 because Clark met that exemption criteria and was not required to expand. Next slide. So before 1152 passed, Washington State was the exception. We're now a little bit closer to the norm. This is a little bit outdated data from NCHO. They haven't done a local board of health profile in the last decade, but it just kind of demonstrates that most local boards of health already had, and this is across the country, this is not Washington State data, this is across the country, had healthcare professionals, elected officials, or somebody with public health training on their local board of health. Again, pre-2021, it was mostly the default was the legislative authority. So we were kind of the exception. To this, we're now closer to the norm, and we now more align across the country of what a local board of health looks like. Next slide. Additionally, you can kind of see that there's different ways of getting on a local board of health. The most common one is being appointed specifically to serve on a local board of health. That's the case with 1152. The county legislative authority appoints non-elected members to that local board of health. Some are designated to serve via statute based on their elected position, county commissioners or county legislative authority being the big one in our state. Some are designated by statute to serve based on their non-elected position, so having a medical member, you know, a representative or community member representative or tribal representative. And then there are a few across the country where you specifically run for office to serve on the local board of health. Not something I would think is very a very popular, you know, elected official position to run for. But, you know, maybe nowadays that's a little bit different. But when the survey was done, I'm sure it was probably hard to recruit people to run for office for the local board of health. Next slide. So community health advisory boards, kind of some general rules and responsibilities. And when I say CHAB, you know, it's community health advisory board, public health advisory committee, public health advisory board, community health advisory committee, different words, they all mean the same thing. So if I use CHAB or CHAC or FAB, I'm using them interchangeably in these contexts. But what advisory boards can do is they add community voice to public health policies and programs. And that it, for public health, community participation and community voice is incredibly important. It's a central value and tenet of the work that we do. They also carry local public health messaging and communications back to the public. You learn about a wide range of public health issues, probably more than you thought you wanted to or knew thought could be possible. But now you're seen as somebody to go to for information for the community. You also serve, advisory boards also provide additional connections and relationships to unique community sectors. A lot of advisory boards will have specific membership requirements of, we want businesses at the table. We want different population groups. We want youth. We want faith-based groups. We want churches. We want schools. We want healthcare. So you might have a unique, a unique membership that you're bringing to an advisory board. You're also advising decision makers, in this case, local boards of health, on the implementation of statute rules and ordinances. So if there is something up for debate in Clark County, you are providing your advice and recommendations on whether to pass something or not pass something, make modifications, not make modifications. And you're advising those decision makers similarly on programs and services that the health department is providing. Next slide. So when 1152 passed, it also included some of that exemption criteria for maintaining just a local board of health made up of the county legislative authority. And that was if a community health board existed, it had to be in place before January 1st of 2022. So for those 24 that I mentioned earlier that didn't have it already, they had a very, very short period of time to get one established, or they could expand their local board of health. But that membership criteria and kind of responsibilities, these are some of the things that were in statute that passed that if you did have a local advisory board to become exempted from that local board of health expansion, these were criteria and responsibilities that you had to make sure were in charters or documents. So you had to have between 9 to 21 community members, all appointed by the local board of health. Your local health officer and your local board of health had ex officio positions. Members had expertise in healthcare, environment, social and economic, government, tribal. If you had tribal members or tribal tribes, urban Indian health institutes, or other health centers within your jurisdiction, community-based organizations, businesses, etc. And then you had specific responsibilities in 1152 as well. Assist the local board of health in the administrator, director, and local health officer recruitment. Use a health equity framework to participate in CHA and CHIP efforts. It didn't designate specifically what health equity framework, but does require a health equity framework for CHA CHIP. Evaluating and advising on proposed public health policies and programs. Very vague, so very up to the different jurisdictions onto what that nuance could look like for that jurisdiction. Providing community forums as requested by local boards of health, so maybe a space to talk about something like on-site septic systems or harmful algal blooms or free fridges in neighborhoods. Making recommendations on local health jurisdiction annual budgets and fees, although the local board of health is the one that sets those, and then advising local health jurisdictions on performance management, health outcomes, that kind of thing. Next slide. Some of the benefits of advisory boards, your policy, it's all about community participation and community voice. So you have policy and funding decisions that have public input and are participatory based, so that you're making decisions based on what your communities are asking for or what your communities are interested in. You're helping prioritize services and based on what the community needs and what the community values, so that CHA CHIP process really is reflecting what the community is asking for. And by community, it could be Clark County or it could be Vancouver or Battleground or Washougal. It could be smaller insular communities within a jurisdiction as well. Again, you have a larger group to carry public health messengers and messages out to the public, which during times of emergencies or really complex issues can be really, really critical in providing education, particularly from somebody who might look like you or be of the same business sector as you. Being able to have somebody that you trust as that messenger can be really, really valuable. You're also able to get a quicker pulse and more specific feedback on community sectors and groups. If the jurisdiction is not hitting the mark on something and just isn't serving as they could, being able to provide that feedback and be able to help the jurisdiction pivot quicker is really helpful. Help center equity is a core value and operating principle. And it also assures a responsive and accountable local health agency in a time where transparency and accountability is really, really important. And there we go. So some of the differences between the models. So having an expanded local boards of health have to fulfill mandates and administration. They have to exist by statute. So they are in charge of enforcing RCWs and local codes. They are in charge of controlling diseases and threats. They set fees. They are decision makers. They set the vision and direction for local health jurisdictions by approving specific policy positions and funding and approving specific programs and services that the jurisdiction might carry out. They also do a lot of community engagement, particularly around risk communications, again, being that voice for the public. On the other hand, community and health advisory boards are in more of that advisory make recommendations role. So they're recommending positions and direction. Doesn't necessarily mean that's what the local board of health would approve, but they're making those recommendations so that the local board of health has that endorsement behind their additional community endorsement behind some decisions that they might have. They're promoting health and safety. They're absolutely engaging with the community and having participation from the community, informing those CHOCHIP efforts. CHOCHIPs being really, really central parts of local health jurisdiction kind of operations and purpose. And then again, advising on those programs and services, enriching and elevating community voice into shaping what those programs and services could look like. I like the delayed loading. I'm just like, what's going to be the next slide?
I might be having an issue here, so I'm going to stop sharing for just a second. Sorry.
No worries.
It looks like it got a little funky when I merged it, so I might just have to pull up.
Okay. If not, I have it. I can share too really quickly if that's.
Yeah, Jamie's got it. She could just share it.
Yeah, that would be totally fine. I'm sorry, everyone.
Nope, no worries. Oh, I'm going to send a request to share. And then,
I approved it, so you should be ready.
yep, there we go. Okay, and then let me scroll down. Keep scrolling. Okay. And hopefully you can see that okay. So when you're working with your local health jurisdiction and your local health officials, again, remembering that local board of health is providing direction, the recommendations, they're providing the supervision for your local health officer, administrator, et cetera. They're the ones passing those local rules, regulations, setting fees. And they're responsible for ensuring agency operations are complying with local, state, and federal requirements. Something that the advisory board could do is say, hey, we're really concerned that the jurisdiction is not, in full compliance, and we want to help you make sure that you're fulfilling your obligation. That could be a role of a FAB. Administration, your local health administrator or director. Clark County is unique in that you have a dual role in one person, but your administrator is implementing that local board of health vision and direction. They're maintaining the budget, the financial management, they're overseeing staff. They're also responsible for that long-term programmatic planning and operations of a jurisdiction. Your local health officer is overseeing enforcement issues and orders. They have statutory obligations in those arenas. So CDC, communicable disease case investigation and control efforts, whether that's pertussis, whether that's foodborne outbreaks, they're responsible for controlling those outbreaks. They might issue abatement orders for environmental health hazards or risks that might be closing down beaches because of harmful algal blooms or E. coli in the water. It could be other mitigation orders around boil water notices, that kind of thing. And then they're also declaring health crises and public health emergencies, COVID being a really obvious one. But they might also declare a health crisis around something like, I think Clark County's done racism as a public health crisis. So more of that social determinants type health emergency that's a little bit less of a flashpoint in terms of an emergency, but is much more chronic. Oop, already did that. So To expand a CHAB or to have a CHAB or to not have a CHAB or to expand the local Board of Health? That is the question. And that is a really hard question to noodle over. I will graciously bow out and say that I don't think there's a right answer. I don't think that there is one model that is better than all the models. I think it really depends on the jurisdiction. And it's a conversation that the county legislative authority needs to have, community members need to be a part of as well. It could be that larger jurisdictions tend to have a much more diverse population. We have some jurisdictions that are very, very homogenous. So community voice doesn't have the breadth and difference of a perspective that a larger jurisdiction may have. We have jurisdictions that are very urban. We have jurisdictions that are very rural. We have jurisdictions that are very mixed. That might have an impact of do we want is a community health advisory board more appropriate or is an expanded local board of health? So thinking of size and diversity of a jurisdiction. Thinking of the magnitude and complexity of health problems, and this kind of goes with the size and diversity of a jurisdiction. What are your CHOCHIP priorities? If they are really, really complex, are they, multidisciplinary? Are you trying to solve something like X or trying to address something like access to care, where you're pulling in public health and healthcare and health insurance providers and government and Medicaid and your ACHs and your MCOs? And your elected officials, and like, is it really a complex issue, or are they more, I don't want to say simple, but are they less comprehensive in scope? Do you have expanded programs and services? Are you providing health and human service, that more social services side of things, as well as public health services? Are you expanding program into things like climate resiliency? Are you doing things within maternal child health and violence and injury prevention and chronic disease prevention? Or do you have a simple, more simple portfolio that might influence you one way or another to have an advisory board or just an expanded board of health? What's the likelihood of having additional emergencies and threats where community voice might be really important? We have jurisdictions that have wildfires every single year. So they might have somebody who is very tied to wildfire or smoke on an advisory board or on a local board of health. We have jurisdictions that tend to be lucky in having additional threats and emergencies. And so, again, what does that participation look like? Are there other pathways for community input and participation into public health agencies? A lot of LHJs have different coalitions or alliances that they work on. They might have an MCH alliance. They might have regular stakeholder meetings with septic installers or food safety workers. They might have a coalition around emergency preparedness. So, are there other ways that community voices influence and that the jurisdiction engages with and can bring things to a local board of health? If they're not, maybe a CHAB is a right pathway, or maybe it's a both and situation. There might be specific work groups or task force, again, really finessing what those programs and services look like, where an advisory board might be redundant, or my advisory board might be enhancing. There might be other governmental boards that also have similar roles and scope too. So, that's another thing to consider and discuss. And where is participation and input most needed? What kind of voices need to be at the table to help inform? Expanded local boards of health have some limitations, and so maybe those limitations are enough of a deterrent where an advisory board is needed and ensures that participation is being utilized the most effective that it could be. And then what is the categorization of your LHJ? Is it county governed or is it special purpose district? That might also influence where you have health district that operates rather autonomously. So having another advisory board to support the local board of health could be helpful. You might be a county where you have more infrastructure at the county level where that might be something that you don't want to talk about. But those are just these are some considerations to kind of discuss and mull over. Again, is there the best? I don't think there is. I think it really depends on the jurisdiction and what is needed and what is desired from either an advisory board or expanded board of health. So some of the limitations that I was alluding to of the models. So local board of health expansion is a requirement, but there is still an obligation to balance membership between elected and non-elected. And this is what I was alluding to easy earlier. A size of a jurisdiction might be where a local expanded local board of health makes sense because it might be a very homogenous population. It might be a very small population. So those expanded categories might be sufficient for adding community voice to a local board of health. You might also have a bigger jurisdiction where you have different community action groups. You might have schools. You might have urban and rural representation. You might have businesses that want representation. So you have a little bit more flexibility to expand that community membership broader into that advisory board rather than try to match elected to non-elected member in a local board of health. That might be that's a limitation of a local board of health expansion. The CHAB model is not mandated or required, so there is no obligation to have an advisory board. So the county legislative authority might say, "Well, CHAB seems like it's more than we have capacity to operate. We're just going to expand the local board of health." They are in their right to do that. The CHAB is advisory in scope only. It is not mandated. There is no authority or power there other than you make recommendations and provide advice to the local boards of health. The local board of health still retains their decision-making responsibility and obligations for mandates. And the models haven't been evaluated. Full disclosure, there has been no evaluation of what is the effective governance structure for Washington State, as well as at the federal level. I don't know if some jurisdictions have taken this up themselves and done some evaluation, but to my knowledge, there has not been a very intensive study of what kind of governance structure is the best in terms of impact on health outcomes, in terms of financial management, in terms of effective public health operations. So I have no evidence to present on either model, just the limitations, the pros and cons for both. A decentralized local government means local control. That is a blessing in that local boards of health can expand, local boards of health can retain their county legislative membership and expand to the CHAB. You have that ability in a decentralized state. If it was a centralized state like New Mexico, the state is dictating how all of those different things happen at the local level. So, if you're in New Mexico, their local boards of health are appointed by the state. There's community health advisory boards, they're appointed by the state. They have clear direction from state agencies, which are run by or which are overseen by the executive office and governor. So, you have a little bit more ability to nuance things at the local level in a decentralized state. And each county operates uniquely. And that is the gift of local control, in that we strive to have a big enough box where everybody can do what they want to within that box, but also try to have some consistency so that there is at least you can kind of recognize the bones and structures within governance as well as operations within LHJs. But in general, there are characteristics, regardless of expanded local boards of health or using advisory boards, that I think make for successful LHJs. Communication is always something that is always a hard thing to do well, always a hard thing to maintain and be consistent in. But when it happens, it is magic. So making sure that there's good communication between all parties. whether that's risk communication on emergencies and threats, whether that is communicating on health outcomes or health factors for communities. So when there are things like foodborne outbreaks, the importance of or food recalls on things like romaine lettuce, being able to educate about the importance of heightened surveillance. The larger the public health areas and agency and programs, the more important that communication is happening. Having a clear understanding of roles and responsibilities, so you're not bleeding into one's authority over another, that's where a lot of tension can happen. So clearly understanding who's in charge of enforcement and action, where do those statutory authorities lie? Where do those responsibilities land for budget and management of budget? Where do those responsibilities lie for policymaking and being advisory? Clearly understanding those roles is really, really important. I think that's where a lot of friction can happen. And we've seen a lot of friction happen across the state of where those responsibilities have bled into one another. And that can create some frustrations in that, oh, we wanna do this, but it's, oh, but you actually don't have the authority to do that. That's the authority of somebody else. Having consistent procedures and processes to navigate some of those tension points or those challenging, particularly challenging topics or challenging issues. Public health is, you know, in unprecedented times yet again. And so having, you know, things written down, operating principles, operating processes, operating procedures can be really helpful to look at. This is how we navigate a challenging issue where the CHAB might take up an issue around vaccination or water fluoridation first, and then they're going to make a recommendation to the local board of health. The CHAB might request presentations by subject matter experts at the health department. They might pull in state experts. Having those clear policies and procedures of how do you make recommendations? Where do you provide that, you know, advisory kind of responsibility? And then having that cyclical engagement with local government, community partners, and the public. So you're not just gathering information from the community. That's a very one way engagement and participation, but you're also then providing that education, promotion, messaging back out, that feedback back out. Having it be a two-way or very cyclical where you are getting feedback in, you're taking that feedback, you're taking that engagement, you're using it, and then you're being able to show action based on that feedback. That to me is what makes successful local health jurisdictions. And those things operate within expanded boards of health, with community health advisory boards, with both. We have some jurisdictions that have expanded local boards of health and CHABs. But these are the characteristics that I think really make a good, successful local health jurisdiction. Some, not limited to. So that was a lot of talking at you. So I just want to say thank you and want to also give you a save the date. We are doing a local board of health training again in October. It will be in Ellensburg, Washington. And past local board of health trainings, CHAB, CHAC, FAB members are also encouraged to attend. We also open it up to state board of health members, since there's a lot of crossover and content with state board of health members as well. Registration is coming soon. If not today, I think NIA might have sent out an open registration, but it is coming soon too. So putting that on your radar. And with that, I'm happy to take any questions or not.
Quiet group out there. That was a very thorough explanation. I appreciate your knowledge and willingness to share that with all of us. So, anybody have any questions or comments?
I just wanted to say thank you. This is Brian with Infection Prevention at Legacy Salmon Creek. Thank you for your time. This was a great presentation. Mm-hmm.
was very clarifying for us to learn about those differences and the importance of the different roles that we play. And we've had quite a bit of discussion about that. So I think it was really great to hear you explain all of that in very easy terms.
Well, I appreciate the invite. And you're not alone in having this conversation. I think it's an important conversation to have on a regular basis. And just as new members come in, you know, that education. And you are not alone in kind of like what, you know, what is our purpose? Why are we here? What, you know, what's the meaning of it all? Other jurisdictions are having those exact same conversations. This is still relatively new. This is a 4-year-old kind of new thing for local health jurisdictions. So it's, you know, it's 4 years old. It's a preschooler, and you know, preschoolers do not run the world for a reason.
This is
Right.
Paul. I have a quick question. Jamie, certainly I do appreciate your presentation. It was a wonderful presentation. And I just got a simple question. In one of the opening one of the opening sites that you showed on that was each of the counties. Below that county it was numbers. Is that the amount of people basically in each of those counties?
Yes, that is April 2024 population numbers. So it's a bit outdated. But yes, that was the population. So King County, just under 3 million, Garfield County, just over 2,300.
Thank you so much. I was wondering about that. Yes. Thank you. Thank you for your presentation.
I would also like to express my thanks. It was a very comprehensive and very well put together and easy to digest presentation. And that's a hard thing to do. So thank you for that. Also, I did have the opportunity to attend one of the local Board of Health trainings. It was like a 2.5 to 3 day training, and it was just superb. So I hope that I might have the opportunity to go through it again because, as we know, things change all the time in the world of public health. And I hope that many people who were not able to attend it before are able to do so this time. So thank you for giving us a heads up that that's coming up in Ellensburg.
Well, hopefully I'll get to see you there again, Marla.
I hope so. Thank you.
Right. Any other comments or questions? All right. Well, thank you so much, Jamie, for your time. Appreciate it. You're welcome to stick around or go do whatever you want for your evening.
I'm off to go water some plants. It's hot in Olympia, and so I got some gardens that's thirsty, so. Thank you again for the invite.
You're welcome.
Alan has my contact information. I'm happy to answer any questions as they come up.
Yeah, I know where to reach her. And Jamie, thanks a lot. That was outstanding. So thank you. Great summary.
Yeah, you bet. Take care, everyone.
Thank you. Bye. All right. Next on our agenda is the Public Health and Action presentation from the two Amys, Amy Wilson and Amy Koski, and it's around the Heat Watch campaign. So I'm going to turn it over to Amy and Amy.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for having us here tonight. I'm Amy Koski. I'm the Built Environment Coordinator, and Amy Wilson will also introduce herself as we each get to our speaking parts. But thanks again for having us. And we're here to talk to you today about the Heat Watch campaign, which was a community data collection event that took place one day last July, where volunteers collected temperature data throughout the county. We will get into the specific results and details of that campaign in just a little bit, but wanted to start off with what that means, Heat Watch. And the next slide, please. So this is what we plan to cover this evening, and it's related to our newer body of work here at Public Health related to heat and health impacts. So we'll be talking about the background on how heat impacts health, the built environment's impact on health and well-being, the Heat Watch campaign and its results, and then we'll get into some moving toward action items. Next slide. These are the objectives for our presentation: to increase awareness and understanding of heat trends in Clark County, to summarize health outcomes from heat and how the built environment impacts heat exposure, to describe the heat mapping project and the results, and identify opportunities to use this data for decision making. So Amy Wilson will now discuss heat in the county and its impact on health.
Great, thank you. Next slide, please. And hi, everyone. My name is Amy Wilson. I'm an epidemiologist with our newly formed Climate Action Program. So I'll start us off by kind of giving some background about heat in Clark County. So why focus on heat? We know that extreme heat is the deadliest weather-related hazard nationally, and summers in Washington are getting longer and hotter, and heat waves are becoming more frequent. So locally in Clark County, we know average temperatures have been increasing. This is a graph that shows the annual average temperature in Clark County from 1895 to 2024. And during this time period, there was almost a 2 degree Fahrenheit increase in the average temperature per century. So heat is becoming an increasing health threat in the Pacific Northwest. And just for example, earlier this month, we saw an increase in emergency department visits for heat-related illness during a heat advisory where temperatures reached almost 96 degrees in Vancouver. Next slide, please. So, how can heat impact health? Exposure to heat can lead to heat-related illness, and that includes conditions like heat cramps, heat exhaustion, and heat stroke. It's been associated with mental health impacts, including things like increased stress and anxiety, and can also exacerbate or make worse existing mental health conditions. Heat has also, exposure has been associated with pregnancy complications, as well as heart and respiratory issues, or making those conditions worse, conditions like cardiovascular disease and asthma, for example. Next slide. So, kind of as I mentioned earlier, we do see health impacts from heat in Clark County. So, this chart shows the count of emergency department visits for heat-related illness, including conditions like heat cramps, fainting or passing out from heat, heat exhaustion, and heat stroke to Clark County hospitals from 2017 to 2024. And under the count in that parentheses, that shows the percentage of ED visits for heat-related illness out of all ED visits during that same time period. So for example, in 2024, there were 76 heat-related illness emergency department visits to Clark County hospitals, which was about 0.6 of all ED visits during that same time period. So there have been over 650 emergency department visits for heat-related illness from 2017 to 2024, with the most visits for heat-related illness in 2021, which was the year of the record-setting heat event, some of you may remember, also called a heat dome, where temperatures reached 115 degrees Fahrenheit in Vancouver. Next slide, please. So, who is most impacted by heat? Some communities are more sensitive to the health impacts of heat, which includes populations like older adults, pregnant people, infants and children, and people with existing health conditions who may take certain medications. And then some populations may be more exposed to heat based on factors like where they live or work, including people living unsheltered or unhoused, people living in urban heat islands, which Amy Koski will cover in just a moment, people without access to air conditioning, those who exercise outdoors, as well as folks who work outside. Next slide, please. I'll pass it back to Amy Kay. Thank you.
All right, so what do we mean when we say built environment? We can move to the next slide, and we've got a definition here for you. So the built environment includes the physical makeup of where we live, work, learn, and play. It involves roads, sidewalks, open spaces, transportation options, as well as homes, schools, and businesses. So all of the things that make up our community, and it really influences our overall community health, individual behaviors, and physical activity and healthy eating. Some of the elements of the built environment, oh, we'll stay back just for a second. Some of the elements of the built environment that impact health and well-being include buildings and building materials, the amount of green space or tree canopy, housing quality, and also urban density. So, depending on where you live and what you do, these elements can have varying impacts on those in our community, making some more vulnerable than others. Next slide. Cities and more developed areas tend to be warmer than surrounding rural or less developed areas. And buildings, roads, and other paved surfaces without shade hold on to more heat than green spaces. One really important factor in heat risk is where you live. And urban heat island or urban heat island effect is a technical term to describe the phenomenon that cities and more developed areas tend to be hotter than surrounding or rural, less developed areas. This is because buildings, roads, and other paved surfaces without shade hold on to more heat than green spaces with more trees, plants, and undeveloped land. And green spaces that absorb sunlight and heat provide shade, release water vapor into their surroundings, and ultimately cool down the ambient temperatures. When these spaces are paved over with asphalt or removed for construction, dense urban areas absorb, retain, and even re-emit heat. This can cause temperatures to increase by over 8 degrees Fahrenheit. So, for Clark County, better understanding the areas in our community that are hotter or cooler based on the urban heat island effect or factors in the built environment can help us better address heat impacts on health. I'll pass to Amy now to discuss the data that we collected in the heat mapping campaign.
Great, thank you. Next slide, please. Okay, so before the heat mapping campaign, we had information on paved surfaces, which is sort of an estimation for warmer temperatures, like the map you see on the right, which shows kind of the darker color is more paved surfaces in Clark County. We also have recorded temperatures for the county, so we had that information before. However, through HeatWatch, we really had the opportunity to fill this important data gap, which was really localized information on which neighborhoods and communities in Clark County are most exposed to heat. Next slide, please. Okay, so yeah, last summer, Clark County Public Health, over 50 volunteers and community and county partners engaged in a one-day data collection event to collect temperatures throughout Clark County. So volunteers attach a temperature sensor to the passenger side window of their cars. They drove pre-planned routes to collect temperatures in neighborhoods throughout Clark County at three different time points, in the morning, in the afternoon, and then in the evening. And volunteers completed 17 routes, which covered almost 170 square miles. So the sensor readings then went to our project consultant, Kappa Strategies, for validation and analysis. And then they created heat maps at those three time points for our community to use, which we'll get into those results now. Next slide, please. And we really want to emphasize and acknowledge how instrumental HeatWatch volunteers and our community and county partners were to this project, as well as support from our consultant and numerous public health staff. Next slide, please. Okay, so here's what the maps from the HeatWatch campaign look like. This is the modeled temperature for the afternoon around the areas that were measured on that day. So we encourage folks to focus more kind of on the patterns. So the hotter sort of red and orange colors and the cooler areas, which are denoted in blue and white throughout the county. Next slide, please. So some key takeaways from that map. In general, areas with more buildings and more development tended to be hotter in the afternoon. And some hotter areas included most of the Vancouver area, places like downtown, Orchards, Fourth Plain, and Fruit Valley, as well as Washougal,
at downtown Camas and downtown Battleground. And some of the cooler areas during the afternoon were places like West and Central Camas, as well as places with more green and natural spaces like Burnt Bridge Creek Trail in Vancouver. Next slide, please. And here is a map of the temperature patterns in the evening. So this is a good estimate of areas that hold on to more heat, kind of getting at that urban heat island effect Amy was talking about earlier. We also know that high nighttime temperatures can be particularly dangerous to public health because without air conditioning or cooling, many people rely on overnight temperatures to cool down. Next slide, please. So in general, during the evening, there was nearly a 10-degree difference in temperature based on where you are in Clark County. And some of the hotter areas included Central and East Vancouver, including places like Cascade Park East, Bennington, and Fisher's Landing East, as well as Washougal. Some of the cooler areas in the evening were places like Ridgefield, Le Centre, Northwestern Vancouver, and Northwest Battleground. Next slide, please. So all of this information and maps are publicly available on our website. They're linked there at the bottom. We also have a summary report on the HeatWatch project, as well as an interactive map available where you can zoom and really dive deeper into this data to look at specific places. And finally, I'll pass it back to Amy. Next slide, please.
So taking all of this information and data into consideration, we'd like to discuss how we can all help move this data toward action. Next slide. To move this data toward action, we do first need to address climate justice and health equity. While heat affects everyone, exposure to heat and health impacts from heat are not distributed equally. Climate justice is all about addressing unequal impacts of changes in climate by prioritizing the health and safety of those who face the greatest risk. This figure shows that we all live in a context of past and current inequitable power and resource allocation, and that within that context, those are who are most vulnerable and most impacted by heat. They're the populations with high exposure to heat, high sensitivity to heat, and more barriers or less access to resources to cope with heat. So, as we go through this diagram, I'll talk through and starting from the top with high exposure, some communities are more exposed due to structural or social factors like where you live, work, or play. For example, an older adult from the houseless community who has shelter in an area with a lack of shade might be more exposed. Additionally, past unfair practices and policies have impacted where people live and zoning, and created and reinforced patterns of inequity. So we know much of the building and development across the US is dictated by a regulatory framework of local zoning ordinances and planning documents that are sometimes outdated. That leads to more development and sprawl, and this has resulted in chronic disinvestment in low-income communities and communities of color. Moving to the high sensitivity section, some communities are more sensitive to health impacts of heat. For example, a person who is pregnant with a pre-existing condition may be more sensitive to health impacts of heat. And finally, we know access to fewer resources impacts vulnerability. Due to systemic injustice or structural barriers, some communities may face barriers or have less access than others to resources that support coping with heat. For example, we also know income inequality plays a factor in accessing important resources to manage extreme heat, such as having access to air conditioning and paying for air conditioning. Additionally, as a result of the chronic disinvestment, low-income communities and communities of color are more likely to have older buildings and housing stock where parks, street trees, and other green infrastructure are often dismantled, allowed to fall into disrepair, or not even built at all, which all contribute to a lack of access to resources. just wanted to note on this diagram and this framework that it's nuanced and overlapping. And folks may identify with multiple communities that have differences in exposure, sensitivity, and access to resources. So someone who works outside and is more exposed, but they can actually afford to use air conditioning at home, might actually be less impacted. So we care about our community members, and those who fall in the middle are the most impacted and most vulnerable. Next slide. Thinking about how we can all help move this data toward action, these are the things that we're thinking about for decision makers, including those of you here tonight on FAC and on the Board of Health. We're presenting these data so you can use them to help inform your decisions. So we encourage you to consider policies that reduce heat islands and promote community resilience, to prioritize resource allocation for neighborhoods with increased vulnerability and heat, to prioritize increasing tree canopy and shade structures, address extreme heat in buildings and urban spaces, and support expansion of energy assistance programs for cooling. Stay back on that slide, sorry. Adoption of the climate element that's currently going before council is another way that the county could help prioritize some of these items on this list. And it is a good first step to help identify how the county can get to implementation. We also encourage decision makers to review the heat mapping data in detail and then use it for decision making, as well as to determine where resources should be allocated. Next slide. The whole community will be involved in this work, and it is a collective process. Data collection is an important part of public health work, and assessing and identifying data gaps and then conducting this type of research and data collection, such as we've done for HeatWatch, helps supplement those gaps. Listed on this slide are some of the opportunities as we move toward action. So at Public Health, we're going to continue presenting the data. We shared the data with some community partners so far, as well as Community Planning Department and Parks and Nature in Public Works. We plan to continue sharing the presentation with other community partners as well. We are monitoring and communicating about heat before, during, and after heat events. And we're sustaining and building community partnerships. To date, we've distributed the outreach postcard that you can see here to Peace Health Southwest, to Fourth Plain Forward, Council for the Homeless, and ECHO, as well as at several active transportation events. This postcard includes heat safety tips and links to HeatWatch data. We also can support capacity building for heat interventions. Our job at Clark County Public Health is to use the data and contextualize it broadly, and then we'll work with partners to find the right resources for those most impacted by heat. Additionally, there's something everybody can do, whether they're a decision maker or not, and that's to be prepared for hot weather. Things like registering for public alerts, making a plan for heat emergencies, checking in on your neighbors, and taking action to promote a healthy community as our climate changes. Next slide. That concludes our formal presentation. We do have a couple of other slides with references after this slide. But at this point, we would be happy to take any questions if there's time for that.
Amy, thank you. And thank you both for all the information. That was really great. I'm embarrassed to ask this, but I will anyway. With the cards, are those something we can print off from the website, or do you have other ones? Like in social services, be happy to have some on our buildings too.
Yeah, we have printed copies, and they're available in six languages in addition to English. We have physical copies of them. So yeah, we're happy to drop those off, as well as send you a PDF if that's of interest. Yeah.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Brian with Infection Prevention at Legacy Salmon Creek. I'm also in would like to have some of those heat advisory. Sorry, it's the end of my day. Yes, the cards as well.
That sounds great. Put your contact information out and happy to drop those off. Thank you.
Great, thank you.
This is Marla Sanger. I also want to really commend the folks that worked on this great presentation. It's something that I think people don't have any thoughts about until they're in that situation where we have our first real hot day and the air conditioner doesn't work. I'm in Southeast Alaska right now, where the low is 52 today and the high is 56. And it feels really good, actually, compared to what I was experiencing in Vancouver. But it has its own issues as well, as you can probably imagine the amount of rainfall, which is well over 100 inches a year. But I do think that what's really important is that you're doing something very well organized and very far-reaching to get the word out to people who could be endangered by heat. It is really a serious problem, and I thank you for the effort you're making to inform people and give them, not just tell them, but give them help about what they can do to protect themselves. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, that was very informative, and I was interested in seeing where the heat spots were, and some were obvious and some weren't so obvious. So, and I guess I worry a little bit when we remove a lot of trees to build new buildings, and I hope that they build more or plant more trees to help keep, because it's obvious where there's the green trees and the greenery, it's much cooler there. So thinking about, when we're building new large complexes, to make sure we have some green space for them as well. All
That
right,
other,
anybody?
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead, Paul.
Oh, great minds in the same path. I was just thinking the same thing. I saw an article the other day about the wood farming and the Amazon, how the Amazon had so much foliage there, and every time that they would cut more logs down, there would be more heat in that area. And to go along with that, in Oregon, they are trying to do a get in the habit of, as they cut down trees, they try to replant where the trees are so that there's more foliage to keep the heat down. So that's kind of an interesting thing. However, I saw on that display that there was, and it could probably have to do with the foliage, that it was warmer in the Washougal area than in the battleground area. So I'm not sure exactly why that would be.
Good question. This has come up before about Washougal specifically, kind of as a warmer area. And we spoke with meteorologists at the National Weather Service, and they commented that this may have more to do with weather actually than factors in the built environment potentially. And so that could be things like wind patterns or other weather-related factors in Washougal that may make it feel warmer. And Washougal often experience kind of has its own microclimate. But yeah, looking forward to sharing this, with and working with City of Washougal and local partners to sort of address that. But sorry, go ahead, Scott.
So actually, I mean, yeah, I was going to comment on that. Clark County actually sits on three different weather patterns. So if you look at I-5 205, that is essentially the northern end of the Willamette Valley. And so that weather pattern is going to be more like what you see in central Portland. When you get out to Washougal, that is the end of the Columbia River Gorge pattern. So as the gorge opens up, you get a lot of that weather pattern coming out of there. And then when you start getting into Battleground, Ridgefield, and La Center, that weather pattern is impacted actually more by the mouth of the Columbia River. And that thing. So that's the reason we can have such very diverse weather throughout the county. And so, yeah, that's why.
Great explanation. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Right. Anything else? Well, thank you, Amy and Amy, for a great presentation. And once again, we all learned something from that. So we really appreciate your work. Good
Thank
job.
you. Thanks.
All right. Next on our agenda is a message from Jeff. He's going to go over some budget information with us. So I'm going to turn it over to Jeff.
Thank you very much, Sandy. I'll be reviewing some budget information and also seeking some feedback on our environmental public health fee proposals for 2026. So some updates. This has been, I want to say, one of the most, I don't want to use the term disjointed, one of the most difficult budget processes to work through because there's so many moving parts that are happening at different times. We have finally received the news regarding our Foundational Public Health Services grant funding, or FPHS. We love acronyms in public health. So our Foundational Public Health Services grant revenue, Governor Ferguson's original budget, if you followed that, that would have resulted in a $1.8 million reduction to Clark County Public Health per year. The entire process finally played out, and what we're actually being hit with is $175,000 annual cut. So it's far, far better than we had assumed it might be, which is good. There's a $75,000 reduction to a categorical water system capacity grant, which can actually be made up through environmental public health fees. And then we have a $100,000 communicable disease data modernization funding source that was spread across three of our CD programs. And that is a deficit that, adds to what we were looking at already. So we're still awaiting some info around our Clark County indirect charges for 2026. We're looking for final labor budget data. We got some data from the budget office, which we've been using thus far. We just need that to be finalized. So the current budget where we're at right now is we have 10 vacant positions slated for elimination. So what I'm going to show you around fees already has those 10 positions eliminated. They're all vacant as of right now. However, we're still looking at around a $250,000 deficit. So we're not done balancing the budget. So as Jamie Bodden presented in her, I mean, talked about in her presentation, one of FAC's responsibilities is guidance around our budget and our fees. So I'm going to get into the environmental public health fee presentation that Dr. Melnick, Danette, and I, we had one-on-one conversations with each of the county councilors last Monday. That's the first step in this process. From that point, we bring these scenarios to you, the FAC, and then the technical advisory committees that represent industry. For example, there's an on-site septic TAC. There's a schools TAG, which is a technical advisory group. And then after we meet with you guys and then those TACs and TAGs, we then have a Board of Health work session on July 23rd. And that's where we'll receive final input from the Board of Health. On which scenario they would like us to draft the ordinance for, which is what will go into code for our 2026 fees. So I'm going to share my screen and go into the presentation that we had. I'm going to go over to do. All right. So this is the presentation that we had with each of the five county councilors. So I'm just going to get started. So the purpose of the presentation, again, is consideration for adjustments to our environmental public health fee schedule, which is a critical element of our annual budget process. There is no voting at the one-on-ones. The county manager wants us to be very clear. All we're doing is seeking feedback on the scenarios that we've provided. And then if there are any additional scenarios they would like to see, we're just bringing three options, and there's unlimited options. They could ask us for numerous other models. So background, we have currently 11 programs in environmental public health. These eight receive user fees. So we've got two drinking water programs, drinking water protection and operations and maintenance, recreational water safety. This is your pools and spas, splash pads, etc. Solid and hazardous waste. This is going to be your garbage dump, recycling centers, etc. We have on-site septic permitting, as well as on-site septic operations and maintenance. We have food safety, and we have school health and safety. So our environmental public health fees, what we're proposing, they are calculated to align with projected program expenses, less any program income. So there is no profit built into these fees. I also bring up in the one-on-one conversations that our fee model has been looked at by the state auditor's office on three separate occasions, and we've always been given a clean bill of health. So from 2011 to 2018, the program costs were supplemented by county general fund to cover what was referred to as greater good activities. So those greater good activities, it's work performed, but not really related to a specific license, permit, or fee. So we got some good examples here, complaint investigations around residential waste, or someone calls and, you know, I saw a mouse in a restaurant, you know, or outbreak investigations such as foodborne illness or waterborne illness. Those are just some examples of what was referred to as greater good. So we used to be on a biennial budget. 2017-18, that was the last time the fees were adjusted under that policy where the general fund supplemented the fees for greater good. That was an adjustment of 1.35%. With the 2019 budget, something I sort of saw coming back when they went down this road, the general fund was not going to be able to afford to supplement these fees forever. The greater good costs, the general fund just could really no longer afford it. So the Board of Health revised their policy approach, and we began the direction to move back towards full cost recovery. That's why you see some pretty big fee increases in 2019, 2020, and 2021. Those were years where we incrementally increased the cost recovery for all those programs. 2022, it's late 2021, they approved the ordinance which set fees at full cost recovery, except for drinking water protection and on-site septic permitting, which are set at 90% cost recovery. And we've been with that model since 2022. And what that 90% cost recovery does is it allows for nominal funding during times of economic downturn. What I can say is those two programs are very, very heavily tied to the construction industry. So in the 2008, 2009, 2010 economic collapse, those programs were absolutely decimated and did not really have revenue through fees to even sustain a position to handle that greater good. So some notes of interest. We talked about this with each of the counselors. This is some cost drivers for the 2026 environmental public health fee adjustments. We talked at a prior FAC meeting about the Me Too grievance that the coalition of four unions inside Clark County filed against the county, and the coalition actually was successful. So the average salary budget expense for our environmental public health staff, field staff, went up 15.93% in 1 year. And then obviously the payroll taxes, those are going to go up commensurately. Our pension costs, our FICA, Social Security, Medicare, A lot of our payroll taxes are based on salary or wages. And then medical insurance, the average medical insurance budget expense for all public health staff, I just ran that calculation. It went up 14.69% in that 1 year also. So I believe the next slide is going to be let's get into the scenarios on what we presented to the Board of Health. This is it. Okay. So we presented three scenarios. This first scenario, this is strictly status quo. So this is aligned with that Board of Health initial policy adopted in October of 2021, where we keep the drinking water protection and on-site septic permitting programs at 90% cost recovery. You'll see some, it's a 16.67% collective increase in fee revenue. You obviously see one outlier here, and that is drinking water operations and maintenance at just under 320%. 2025, this is the first year that program has existed. It was budgeted as a 0.6 FTE program. It did not take us long to see that needed to be more FTE than that. It is budgeted in 2026 to be 1.5 FTE. So it's almost triple in staff, and it lost that $75,000 water system capacity grant. This is the program it was in. So that's where, unfortunately, we lost a grant that helped sustain some of those fees. So that's why you see a 318% jump in that fee revenue. Scenario number two, it is further advancing the cost recovery. So what this does is this takes those two programs that were at 90% cost recovery and advances them to full cost recovery. Like I said earlier, all we do is we bring forward scenarios to the Board of Health. They can elect to do whatever they choose to with fees. Personally, we're looking at a very difficult budget in 2026. I can already see a difficult 2027 budget. I don't see anything rosy. I don't see a lot of light at the end of the tunnel. So that nominal funding to allow for some staffing during economic downturn, what we're looking at is if we go to full cost recovery, that actually does free up some general fund support that we could use elsewhere to sustain positions. And these are programs that, while we don't like to raise user fees, if it comes down to a slightly larger increase in user fees to save someone's position or part of someone's position, we have to at least bring that up as a scenario to the Board of Health. And then scenario number three, this is basically using scenario number two in advancing all the fees to 100% cost recovery. However, this is a one-time use of some excess department fund balance to limit any individual fee from going up more than 5.0%. So what this does, I'm going to actually open my other attachment here. Let me have to minimize this. So this is the food safety program, and you'll see under scenario one and two, you see increases of this individual fee. You'll see an increase of 29.08%. Well, the increase in scenario number three is 4.98%, and the reason it's not 5.0 is just rounding. We don't charge fees with nickels and dimes. We round them to the nearest dollar. So you'll see this scenario number three; they're all at 5.0 or below. Now, there are some fees in this program where the fees were actually going down. And what this does is this only limits the fee change if it was above 5% initially. So if we go back to the presentation, you'll see that the increase in revenue in food safety is only 2.88%. The reason it's not 5% or close to 5% is because there are fees in that model where the fees are going up below 5 or going down. The outlier that jumps out here is school health and safety. You'll see a 19.9% increase. This is the increase in revenue. None of the fees are going up more than 5%. In fact, most of these fees are going down. The reason you see a 19.90% increase in revenue is we had some clarification on the requirements for schools to undergo the environmental health assessment every 3 years. It wasn't clear It wasn't as clear. The state legislature made it clear. So this is now assuming that one third of all schools will undergo their environmental health assessment in 2026. So it's not an increase in fees. It's an increase in fee payers, which means that the revenue is going up. I hope that makes sense. It's not an increase in the fees. It's just there's more people paying the fees. So it's so the revenue is just going up. So again, with the Board of Health, we talked about next steps, and the first bullet there is actually what we're doing right now, and that is reviewing the fee model scenarios with FAC. And like I said earlier, we also review them over these next few weeks with the technical advisory committees, followed by the Board of Health work session July 23rd. And then we'll finally bring forward the final ordinance to the Board of Health hearing in September. So I'm going to stop sharing for a second so I can see hands. If there are any questions, I would be happy to answer them. I guess let me say one more thing before I take questions. We bring these scenarios forward to the Board of Health individually and one-on-ones. And like I said, they can ask us for different scenarios. They can say, hey, can you bring us this other view, this other percentage? They set policy. I emailed our managers yesterday a synopsis of these one-on-ones, and I think there was pretty broad support for scenario number three, where we're using our fund balance, which is sort of like our savings, like a rainy day fund savings to mitigate the fee increase. And what we talked about with the Board of Health is it allows us time to make sure that we are as efficient as we can be with taxpayer funds and ratepayers. We want to, you know, take the time to keep those fees from going up as much as they would otherwise, just to make sure that we are responsible and we're nimble. So I guess now I can take any questions you might have.
Yeah, I had a question.
Sure.
So you had a bunch of programs listed. So each program independently has to fund itself. You can't like add them all together. And so you could spread the pain across more evenly, because each program has to independently versus the whole group.
So the Board of Health could elect. So that's such a great question. I've been here since the late 90s. We had a prosecuting attorney's representative that was assigned to us say, you could fund all of your environmental health division out of your food safety fees. So you could charge all the restaurants enough money to fund school health and safety, drinking water, recreational water, solid hazardous waste. We've never been asked for a scenario that goes that direction. This is assessing the charge at the user. It's based on the program costs. It's not, we've never been asked for a view of that. We can't generate a profit at the division level, without the board, electing to do that. Great question, but we've never been asked to actually present that as an option. I have heard it is an option.
Yeah, because then you would have a little bit more flexibility if you go back to like your scenario two or one.
Yeah.
If you just said, hey, in total, we want to increase, I don't know. And then it wouldn't be somebody getting 300 and somebody getting, it's just.
Yeah.
It seems like this, you could increase a couple and get where you want to be. I don't know. But yeah. If you can't do that, then you can't do that.
I think it would be hard to, it's not impossible. And it's not, according to the prosecutor, like I said, years ago, it's not, in their opinion, not something we couldn't do. I do want to say this 16.67%, this is just the increase in revenue. Food safety has a significant amount of this fee revenue. It's sort of hard to explain. The weighted average, this would be the weighted average. So it's, yeah. Some fees are going down. So in this case, drinking water protection, those ratepayers, if we went with an average, we would be increasing fees where their fees should really be going down. I do recognize the 318%. That is drastic. Yeah. I could come up with a model and bring that forward as well. We have a hand up.
Yeah, hi, it's Brian. So in scenario three, you mentioned that you're kind of like dipping into your savings. Did you do any assessment of like long-term effects of that? But
Yes. Yeah,
makes sense.
so we've been given permission to tap into our fund balance for what we've been calling a glide path related to our budget. We've got a pretty substantial fund balance. We've been having conversations with the county manager about that, and we talked to the county finance team, which is where this conversation originated. I actually went to two members of the county finance team to discuss our fund balance. And we had the conversation with a bigger finance team, and they actually advised using our fund balance to mitigate just our budget challenges over the short term. Fund balance, by its nature, best practice is to not spend it on ongoing costs, but only on one-time expenses, because it's not going to be there forever. It is a one-time revenue source, because once you spend your fund balance, it doesn't always regenerate. And we do have a minimum fund balance policy that the county council approved. It's 2.5 months of operating cash, plus $1 million for emergency response startup. If COVID-25 hit us, we could use that $1 million of emergency response to begin response activities. So yes, we have done I would say a thorough analysis of our fund balance and our savings. Yeah. Excellent
Thank
questions. You
you.
guys, those are some awesome questions. Alan or Jeanette, is there anything you want to add?
I would just caution on the one attorney that in their interpretation, thinking that we could fund the entire environmental health program with, just one set of fees. And for those that don't know me, I've worked in several different jurisdictions and different states. And I would say we would have to jump through a few hoops and verify that before we went down that path, because I think the state auditor's office or other auditors may say no way, because it's always ultimately a business owner or a residential owner that's, paying for their septic to be installed is subsidizing someone else's business if we do it that way. And I don't think that would pass the straight face test type thing.
Yeah, the work we've done on this, and Jeff has done great work on this, is that we can actually show the work we've done. We can relate the fees to the actual cost, the time, the workforce involved in doing the work and doing the inspections, for example, as well as we can identify the greater good costs, the costs of associated with a restaurant food outbreak or something like that. So we can actually we can show the work and show the community that these fees are actually based on the cost of doing the business.
Yeah, I think even if we could go with a different approach around the fees, I think I agree with Danette, just the optics, and it I think that would be a challenge. That would be a big challenge.
And
Any individual segment of the industry of any industry saying you're going to fund or you're going to take on a fee increase when realistically you should have had your fee should have gone down. I think that would be a challenge for our elected officials.
Jeff, you didn't show the fees themselves, did you? Did you show
I
the
showed a few,
hmm. Okay.
I did. I can show more.
The main slide is the revenue slides, but the in some cases the fees are going down, believe it or not. But the idea of using the fund balance, I think you mentioned that was to it is one time, but is to re it's to reduce the sticker shock of a large increase in this year, this next year.
So this is school health and safety, where it was showing a 19 point something percent increase, 19.9% increase in revenue with that subsidized approach. But you'll see you've got fees going down 30%, 45%, 45%, 33%, 31%. There are some fees going up, but most of them are going down. And again, that the reason the revenue is showing an increase of 19.9% is there's more people paying the environmental health assessments, which is these four fees here. There was, again, there was sort of uncertainty around, were these mandated? Was there any teeth? And there was, I would say, clarification given at the state level in this budget process. Yeah, this is where asking FACT to advise on budget and fees is very, very challenging, because there's so many moving parts and there's so many nuances to this stuff. Being able to engage you sufficiently so you can say, I stand behind this, I feel strongly about this, it's definitely a challenge.
One thing I wanted to ask about was the one where the drinking, like, all of these are, they fall on a certain number of people. So like food safety fees are going to fall on restaurants, but something like drinking water operations and maintenance fees, I mean, that's going to be like user costs in our water bills, right? And so
actually,
no,
thankfully, no. It is Group B water owners. Alan, is that right?
Yeah,
it's Group B systems.
The big systems are Group A. Those are done by the state. We do the Group B, which is anywhere from 2 to 15 hookups.
I mean, theoretically, then that's actually like worse. I was thinking like, oh, $253,000 divided by like all the people in Clark County, like, well, I'll pay $1. That's not the end of the world, even though it looks really big. But if we're talking about like, you know, it's how many people are going to be on the hook for this fee?
There's a lot of Group B systems. Jeff, do you have the number?
I'm opening it up right now. Yeah. So there was 978 properties that paid a Group B operating permit in 2020, or that are slated to pay a drinking water operating permit in 2025. The fee that was approved for 2025 was $81.28, and that goes on the property tax rolls. The proposed fee at the large increase went all the way up to $343. However, scenario number three keeps that fee from it. The fee goes from $81.28 to $85.34, so it's an increase of $4.06 for those property owners. It's another reason why I like scenario number three. I want to make certain that our drinking water operations and maintenance program is as efficient and nimble as we can make it. We're saying we need 1.5 FTE. Do we need 1.5 FTE? If we really do, then in 2027, the fee will have to show that. Such great questions. I love it.
So Jeff, this is Lori. So just adding on to that, then what you're saying is if this, this reinforces the need for the 1.5 FTE, then in 2027, realistically, it will go up to $300 and some odd for.
That's where it's a Board of Health policy decision. You know, if they want to go full cost recovery, and that's where our costs are at, that's what it would do. I've also said the Board of Health could eliminate all of our fees and just give us County General Fund to supplement all this work. It's never going to happen, but they could. They could have us collect 50% and give us General Fund for the rest. They could have us. I think Tracy threw out her question was around, could we equalize the fee adjustments? They could. That's an option. You know, they could do a lot of things. That one, I agree with Danette. We would want to make sure the prosecutor, our current prosecutor's representatives agree with it. But Yeah, it's if they want to go 100% cost recovery and that's what our costs show, that's what the fee would be, unfortunately. Yeah.
Hey, Jeff, this is Bree again. Is there a way with scenario three to incrementally increase, like in a quarterly fashion for 2027? Like instead of, you know, it's an increase for full cost recovery.
Another great question. So a lot of these are what we call schedule billing. So like all of the pools and spa owners, they're billed like in March. All of the schools are going to be billed in October. Like it's the way I would like to answer that is I would hope we still have some fund balance for 2027 to continue a slight mitigation. So what we've presented thus far is just using fund balance, for 2026 fees. If we have excess fund balance for 2027, maybe we could limit those increases to like 8.5%. So we're doing a glide path into these fees. Now the drinking water O&M fee needing to go up 300%. At some point, you don't have fund balance to glide that in. You're going to have a big increase. I can completely acknowledge that. So then it comes down to, are we really being as efficient as we can be with the ratepayers? So that's where it's on us to make sure that is the case. So the quarterly approach would be difficult to pull off simply because of the schedule billings. However, if you look at it across a few years, that would be manageable.
Yeah, a quarterly approach would actually increase our costs of having to bill four times a year.
We just wouldn't. Yeah, we wouldn't be able to. We wouldn't. Yeah, that would be hard. But we could. We could, though. Like I said, continue using fund balance if we have it to sort of continue glide pathing.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah. So I know, like I said, the feedback we got from the counselors, they were pretty supportive of scenario number three, merely because it does use our fund balance, which has built up the last handful of years, to not sticker shock ratepayers. Some of these drivers are related to the Me Too grievance filed by the labor unions and the cost of medical insurance going up and the Baker-Tilly salary alignment study, you know, our costs and the decision to remove solid waste from public health also had a $400,000 negative impact to our budget. So there's a lot of these cost drivers that come into play. I don't know how many people are left from FAC. Is there support for scenario number three among the FAC members who remain here? We don't need to take a vote. We do need to get some feedback. Bree, your hand's up again. Bree.
Oh, I was just raising my hand to say yes.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. And I support number three. You got a tough budget. Sounds like the budget I had to do for my hospital.
Yeah. Right now, these fees, again, are based on us eliminating 10 positions, and we're still not balanced. So it's not a fun. I've been doing this a long time. This is not a fun process for me.
Never. Never would be. So hard.
Well, Jeff, I think you've done a really good job, and I guess I would support the recommendation for number three as well.
And this is Paul. I'll take three.
Three for me. This is Marla.
All right. I see some more threes. Yeah. Yeah.
Looks like you've got a pretty good support there, Jeff.
Okay. I really appreciate it. I really appreciate your time. We're going to eventually have to find a way to have more engagement around budget and the process, probably off the budget cycle, because by the time the budget season starts, it's a sprint. I said this last year, I think, and this is a struggle. It's a struggle.
Whatever kindness you can lean towards the restaurateurs, I greatly appreciate it. That's a joke.
No, All right. Thank you, everybody. I know we're running out of time. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Jeff. I appreciate it. Yeah, we're down to 3 minutes left. And does anybody have a burning community update that they want to share? I don't want to leave that off the agenda. Doesn't look like anybody's stepping up. So our next meeting will be July 22nd, and we get to meet person in face we get to meet face to face in July. It's getting late. It's an hour later where I am in Wyoming, so it's
No.
getting late for me. My brain's turning off. But July 22nd, we'll meet at the community Center for Community Health, and I'm sure Mallory will drum up a wonderful dinner for us. And so we'll start dinner at 5 o'clock, and then the meeting will start at 5:30 as usual. So July 22nd is our next meeting. And thank you everyone for such great conversation tonight. I think we had a really full agenda, but we had a lot of really good information shared with us. So I'm happy, and thanks for hanging in there. Have a great month, and we'll see you in July.
Thank you for the direction,
Bye.
Sandy.
Thank you.
Thank
Bye.
you. Thank you. Bye.
Thank you.